The city of Arras is often bypassed as people head down to the Somme. But it's a beautiful city now with a long history dating back to pre-Roman times. And beneath its city streets, Arras hides an incredible network of tunnels and catacombs, which played their own important role in the First World War. And if people do stop at Arras, they tend to head for the beautiful city centre, or they visit the Arras Memorial to the Missing. But how many people visit the small battlefield cemeteries dotted around the city itself, some of which are within the streets of Arras, now swallowed up by the expanding city itself? The 1917 Battle of Arras is probably the most famous action that took place in this part of France, and is statistically, on a daily rate, even bloodier than the Battle of the Somme that had taken place in the previous year. And when you walk those battlefields now, you see why it's so open. Those fields are so open. There was no cover, really, at all for any of the advancing troops that attacked the Germans repeatedly between the 9th of April 1917 and the 16th of May. Just over a month, much shorter than the battles at Ypres and on the Somme. We're fast approaching the 109th anniversary of the Battle of Arras and the Canadian capture of Vimy Ridge. We're going to have a very special episode soon of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, with a Canadian historian and podcaster, Samantha McRae. She's going to come on soon and tell us how the Canadians came together to capture Vimy Ridge. But in this episode, a bit like the last two, we're going to be visiting the Arras battlefield, and much of this podcast was recorded on the battlefield, as we visit some of those small, forgotten cemeteries, battlefield cemeteries. Most of these, or many of them anyway, were concentrated in the 1920s into the enormous concentration cemeteries that we see. But some of them were left behind. Some of them, the commission decided that they would add to the history of those battles. And some of them are very, very small and tucked away in little corners of the Arras battlefield. And some you can't even get to by vehicle. You have to get out your vehicle and walk down a little lane or a path. And there you find the stories of the men that gave their lives on these battlefields. So what we're going to do this week, we're going to visit several of those cemeteries that perhaps don't get talked about very much. And we're going to see and hear and tell the stories of the men that are buried beneath those headstones in these quiet cemeteries, away from the busy city of Arras, and those quiet farming fields now. It seems a different lifetime, a different story, a different history, a different world perhaps, to what they experienced in the Great War. These really are tales from the battlefields this week. Tales about soldiers whose stories I know have never been told before, because it's me that's researched them for families, or because of their connection with my hometown, Northampton. But they're all unique stories, and by telling them, we keep their memories alive. So before we start talking about the cemeteries around Arras, I just wanted to have a quick reflection on last week's podcast that I did about Martin Puich on the Somme. And I found some, just going through some books, I found an account written by the journalist Philip Gibbs, and he was at Martin Puich. I think we've quoted him before in the podcast. He talks about what happened there on the 15th of September 1916, that first day when the tanks went into action. And it's such a powerful account written by a professional writer that I thought it was worth including in this week's podcast as a follow-up, really, to last week. Gibbs says this. So he's talking about the 15th Scottish Division as they attacked the village of Martin Puich from Bazentine. He says these men were superb and went across no man's land for nearly 1,000 yards in 6 minutes. Racing, he says. They made short work with the Germans, who tried to snipe them from the shell craters, and only came to a check on the outskirts of Martin Puich, where they were received with a blast of machine gun fire. It was then the turn of the tanks. Before the dawn, two of them had come up out of the darkness and lumbered over our frontline trenches, looking towards the enemy as though hungry for breakfast. Afterwards, they came across no man's land, like enormous toads with pains in their stomachs, and nosed at Martin Pooey before testing the strength of its broken barns and bricks. The men cheered them wildly, waving their helmets and dancing round them. One company needed cheering up, for they'd lost two of their officers the night before in a patrol adventure, and it was the sergeants who led them over. 20 minutes afterwards, the first waves were inside the first trench of Martin Pooey, and in advance of them waddled a monster. The men were held up for some time by the same machine gun fire which had killed so many of our men, but the monsters went on alone and had astounding adventures. They went straight through the shells of broken barns and houses, straddled on top of German dugouts, and fired enfilade shots down the German trenches. From one dugout came a German colonel with a white, frightened face, who held his hands very high in front of the tank, shouting, "Kamerade, Kamerade!" "Well, come inside then," said a voice in the body of a beast, and a human hand came forth from a hole opening suddenly and grabbed the German officer. For the rest of the day, the tank led that unfortunate man about on the strangest journey the world has ever seen. Another tank was confronted with 100 Germans who shouted, "Mercy, mercy!" and at the head of this procession led them back as prisoners to our lines. Yet another tank went off to the right of Martin Pooey and was so fresh and high-spirited that it went far into the enemy's lines as though on the way to Berlin. The men were not so fortunate as the monsters, not being proof against machine gun bullets. The enemy concentrated a very heavy fire upon them and many fell. One boy, a fine, stout-hearted lad, who had had a keen and spirited look in spite of a dreadful experience, told me a tale. A German crump killed a lance corporal by his side and buried them both completely. "It was just my steel hat that kept the earth from my face," said the boy, "and gave me a little handful of air to breathe. It was a wee trench we had dug to get some cover, but now I was covered too much. It seemed like an hour I was there, but perhaps no more than half that time. I tried to shout but could not. A man walked over my head, but did not know I was there. Presently, they saw the lance corporal's leg sticking out and started to pull him out. I got my hand out and waggled it, and they started digging for me. It was just time. The veins were starting out of my head and I was nearly gone. It was late in the afternoon before the whole of Martin Pooey was taken after fierce fighting, and it was the crowning triumph of a successful day."
So we've now arrived in a village called Morey, M-O-R-Y, and we've found the Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery called Morey Abbey Military Cemetery. The village here was occupied by the Commonwealth troops in the middle of March 1917. So this is after the Germans have withdrawn from the area, demolishing, smashing everything in their way. But it was then lost a year later during the German spring offensive, and then captured again by the British in August of 1918. There are German burials here in a plot on the west side of the cemetery. They were made between March and August of 1918 when the Germans were here. And the Commonwealth plots were established in March 1917. And there are 1, 2, 3 cemeteries which were closed down and the burials concentrated here, which means that Morey Abbey Military Cemetery now contains 619 Commonwealth burials from the First World War, 101 of which are unidentified. And there's also 230 German burials buried here by the Germans during that period that they occupied it in the middle of 1918. And one of the most famous, probably the most famous Commonwealth Imperial War Graves Commission architects, Sir Edwin Lutyens, he was responsible for the design here. So we're going to go into the cemetery now, up the steps. It's been raining here this morning on the Somme, but the weather has now improved. The sun's beginning to peep through and the daffodils growing, giving some colour. The grass has recently been mowed by the commission. The headstones have been cleaned. The flower beds have been hoed. the grass trimmed, and I've come here to see one particular soldier. His name was Private Thomas Merrill, and he was serving with the mechanical transport of the Army Service Corps when he died on the 6th of April 1917 at the age of just 20 years old. And he's in plot one, row A, grave number 5. And here he is. There is no personal inscription on the bottom of his grave, which is always sad to see, but we know a little bit about him because I found a couple of articles about him in the local newspaper. It came from Northampton, which is why I'm interested in finding him. And the newspaper tells us that a member of the mechanical transport, Private Thomas Merrill, was the eldest son of Mr. and Mrs. Merrill of 13 Vernon Street, Northampton, is reported killed in action on April the 5th, although his headstone says the 6th. The deceased enlisted in January last year and had been in France for 11 months, and he was formerly employed as a bus driver by Messrs. Gross Limited, so that's why he was then maybe conscripted into the mechanical transport of the Royal Army Service Corps. Two other brothers were serving, one at the front, and a letter from a lieutenant in the Royal Engineers, which he was attached to, says, at 5:30 p.m. on April the 5th, while your son was helping to carry up signal stores to where my men were working, a mine in a crossroads exploded, killing your son immediately. Two other men were also in the car, were severely shaken. So that tells us that he was a victim of that German withdrawal from the area in March of 1917. They've left booby traps and mines, and his car that he's in has gone over one of those mines in the road, and it's killed him. Back home in Northampton, his mother and father wrote a poem about him. It says that he was only a private soldier, a mother's youngest son, buried on a field of battle. His duty he had done. And we've got a photograph of him, together with those newspaper articles which I've just read to you, and I place that in front of his grave. And hopefully other visitors, if people do come here, will come and pay their respects to him as well, because they'll be able to see the face behind the headstone, and they'll be able to see that poem that I've just read to you. And as I look up just behind him, there's those 230 German headstones with the angled top of the headstone, making them different to the British headstones. But we've got a Victoria Cross here as well. Plot 3, G4. There's a photo of him there, look. But look at his other honours.
Yeah.
He's got the VC, DSO and Bar, so twice. Military Cross and twice mentioned in dispatches. North Irish Horse. He was commanding a tank corps in September of 1918. So this is when, if you remember, the Germans have taken possession of this area in March of 1918. And then in the August, we've come back and pushed them out. And he's died in that final advance. He said he was 40 years old and he'd served in the Boer War at the turn of the century. And he came from Trafalgar Square in Chelsea, London. And his citation says, for most conspicuous bravery, leadership and self-sacrifice. During an attack, the infantry having lost their bearings in the dense fog, this officer at once collected and reorganised any men he could find and led them to the objective in face of heavy machine gun fire. Throughout the whole action, he displayed the most utter disregard of danger, and the capture of the objective was in a great part due to his initiative and gallantry. Can see there, those men there that are all buried. That is effectively a mass grave. We can tell by the touching headstones. Yeah. Well, they're a tank corps. They're a tank crew. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. So there's a horrible story behind them, and I'm going to find out what that is.
So now, back home in Northampton, I have indeed discovered what happened to those seven men on the day they died, the 2nd of September 1918. And also I realise I didn't mention the name of that VC reciprocants. His name was Lieutenant Colonel R.A. West, who died on the 2nd of September 1918, aged 40. And then I mentioned about the seven Tank Corps men that were buried together. Their headstones were touching, and that means that they were probably from a single tank that was destroyed on the battlefield, and when their bodies were recovered for burial, they couldn't actually work out which soldier was who. They're effectively buried in a mass grave, a small mass grave, but their names are recorded on individual headstones, which might not necessarily be directly above their individual bodies. That date, the 2nd of September 1918, the 12th Battalion of the Tank Corps were involved in action during the final 100-day offensive. If you remember, it began on the 8th of August 1918, and on this day, the 12th Battalion was serving with the 62nd Division of the British Army, and they had 18 tanks in action that day with 0 hour at 5:30 a.m., dawn. The accounts of operations tells us that the weather was fine and it became light soon after 0 hour. The ground was often impassable for tanks, being of stiff clay with numerous sunken roads and steep banks. 8 tanks crossed the start line with the infantry of 187th Brigade, 0 hour. The right section of 4 tanks cleared the ground along the Mortius Road and came under heavy fire from field guns and anti-tank rifles, some of which were fired from a derelict Whippet tank. So what the Germans have done there, they've discovered a British broken down tank and they've used that as a defensive position to fire from. But the account tells us that they were silenced with 6-pounder fire, though the cannons from the British tanks. In the growing light, the tanks discovered and engaged numerous targets, and Lieutenant Sanders' tank fired 4,000 rounds of small arms ammunition. That's the machine gun that supports the cannon in the British mail tank. But they then had to withdraw as all 5 crew were wounded. They attempted to drive the tank back, occasionally firing the one remaining Lewis gun. The tank was then hit on the rear and set alight. The crew were all evacuated. A second tank was hit and burnt out, and the remaining 2 tanks had to withdraw due to casualties to the crew. The tanks were hit and knocked out by enemy field guns in the open. A third tank ditched and all the crew were wounded. The last tank turned back before reaching its objective, as it had suffered many crew casualties. The official history states that 6 tanks were knocked out by anti-tank rifle fire. That was B Company. C Company, 1 tank broke down before it reached the start line. At 5:30 a.m., the British barrage came down and the tanks decided to attack unsupported by the infantry, which had still not appeared. The tanks continued forward into the German lines, silencing those machine guns that were found. Many others sprang up once the tanks passed and engaged the infantry, who finally attacked 40 minutes late. The tanks came under fire from advanced field batteries. One tank in the left section, which had broken down soon after zero, was hit 5 times and burnt out. 3 other tanks were knocked out by direct hits. 1 crew was entirely killed or wounded. A 5th tank was hit and burnt out. The other tanks patrolled, waiting in vain for the infantry to appear. Eventually they withdrew, 1 more tank being hit and knocked out whilst returning. That day, whilst progress was being made, we see from that account that the tanks were vulnerable to German fire, even at this late stage in the war. The casualties that day were 1 officer and 56 other ranks killed, wounded or missing. So of those 18 tanks that advanced, 1 failed to start, 2 ditched or broke down, 10 out of the 18 were hit and knocked out. And somewhere along the way, those 7 men whose headstones are touching were victims of that German anti-tank rifle fire, or perhaps from the German artillery fire that's hit their tank and probably set it on fire. We can only imagine the horror that took place inside that tank. And that's why it's so important that we remember those 7 lads that are now at peace in this beautiful cemetery, cared for by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. Those 7 men were Alfred Siflete, and his wife chose the inscription just as loved by all. And for years afterwards, on the anniversary of his death, she paid tribute to him in the local newspaper. Then there's Private G.H. Greentree and William Ireland, aged 25. Greentree was 36, Siflete was 26, and Ireland's family chose the words, "In loving memory from his loving wife and daughter, thy will be done." Frank Goodall doesn't have his age or any family inscription on his headstone. But Private Blakeborough, who was just 20 years old, family chose these words, "He left all he loved at home and died so that others might live." Private J.R. Wilson, another one that doesn't have an age or an inscription, and neither does the last one, Private S.H. Scott. Whoever they were, I know they were from different parts of the country, they were comrades in arms. They'd learnt together, they'd trained together, they'd fought together, and for perpetuity, they'll be together, side by side.
So just a couple of miles away from Moree Abbey Cemetery is another rather large cemetery without too many beautiful features in it, more of a functional cemetery called the HAC Cemetery in the village of Coust, St. Maine. And people that watched the 1917 film a few years ago will remember the story of the soldiers breaking through the old German lines, moving into the fields. And one of the stars of the film, one of the key players in the film, discovered a young mother in a village, and that's the village here at Coust. That's where that part of the film was set. But we've come here to see a couple of notable burials. We walk along the graves and we see stone after stone of unknown soldiers here in this cemetery. But it's this man that I've come to see, Reginald Herbert Garrard, the King's Royal Rifle Corps, another of our Northampton men. The newspaper tells us a tragic waste of our bravest and best lives in this terrible war is again emphasised by the death in action on the 23rd of April 1917 of Second Lieutenant Reginald Garrard, aged 22, the eldest son of Mr. and Mrs. George Garrard from Wantage Road in Northampton, which for cricket fans will know that's where the Northamptonshire County Cricket Club is, was then and still is. Nature has endowed him with exceptional gifts of heart and mind, as well as an imposing physique, for he stood 6'2", which was tall in those days. He towered above most youths in his academic attainments, for he became the prefect and captain of the Northampton Town and County School, which is now the boys' school, the grammar school, from which he won a mathematical scholarship at Exeter College at Oxford. He was studying at the university when war broke out, and though fighting was hateful to his refined, sensitive nature, he never hesitated to respond to the call and he joined the officer training corps. He was given a commission in the East Surreys in January of 1916, and after training in Devonshire and Ireland, he was transferred to the King's Royal Rifle Corps. He left for France in July 1916, and he was in the fighting 4 days later. He'd been at the front ever since, with the exception of 10 days home, when he unexpectedly arrived home on the last day of the year. He looked the very ideal of a British officer, and those who knew his character and capabilities could not help but feel the sadness of risking a career so full of brilliant achievement and promise to the chances of enemy bullets. He has fallen, as he was bravely ready to do, for no murmurs ever escaped him concerning the hardships and horrors of warfare. In fact, the most marked characteristic, can't even say it, of his nature was his reticence and modesty. With all his cleverness, he never boasted and accepted all the success as a matter of course. Those who knew him especially endorsed the following tribute to his memory from Edward Reynolds, headmaster of the Northampton Town and County School. I knew him as very few knew him. With all his great ability and promise and kindness and goodness, and his death has come to me as a great shock, even in these times. To the bereaved parents, the deepest sympathy will be extended in the loss of such a splendid son. His father, for over a quarter of a century, had been the secretary of the Smiths Timber Company Limited, received the fatal telegram last Thursday. The final meeting for the liquidation of the company had been held on the same day. And a little later came news that Lieutenant Brown of the Gloucesters, a very dear friend of the family, had been killed on the following day. And this is the Battle of Arras in April of 1917. Bloody April. Yeah, well, that was in the air, but bloody April on the ground as well.
It was.
Where he lived, the house that he lived, is less than half a mile from where I live.
Okay.
Oh, that was tough to read, that. There's a shot at dawn here.
Oh, is there?
Yeah. Should we see if we can go and find him?
Yeah.
So this cemetery, or at least 10 cemeteries were closed down to form this cemetery. There's 1,921 burials here, including 741 from the UK, 65, these are the ones that identified, 65 from Australia, 17 Canada, and 4 from New Zealand. But there's over 1,000 that are unidentified as well. And our shot at dawn soldier is in plot 8. And then over on the right-hand side of the cemetery, we find plot 8, which faces a different direction to all of the others. And in plot C, in row C within plot 8, we walk down the row. And nearly all of them in this row are named. There he is. Rifleman R15325, John Woodhouse. Died on the 4th of October 1917 while serving with the King's Royal Rifle Corps. No personal inscription on his headstone, no family inscription. The reason for his death relates to Ypres.
Okay.
Don't know how he's ended up here, but he was shot at dawn. And this is bang in the middle of the Battle of Passchendaele. He came from Birmingham, volunteer. He was subject to a suspended sentence of death when, prior to an attack during the Battle of Langemarck, he made off. 16 days later, Woodhouse was found under a hedge near Calais. And because he was on a suspended sentence, he's shot at dawn. So they must have brought him, by which time maybe his battalion had moved here and they brought him down here and executed him. Well, he's involved in the worst battle of all. The Battle of Langemarck is in August. It's a dreadful situation. The rain is coming down. It's awful. And he's just panicked. He's just lost his head.
Because you wonder about the mates with him.
Yeah, well,
someone,
you see,
must have known that he was freaking out.
Yeah, there's all those complications, but there doesn't seem to be much sympathy from the men because he's letting them down.
Yeah,
you know?
That's quite selfish.
Yeah, and he's quite a notable man here. Look, Captain Oberon Thomas Herbert, the 8th Baron Lucas and the 11th Baron of Dingwall. Oh, he's a pilot. 3rd of November 1916. We'll have to find out about him, won't we? Not often you see barons buried here. He's obviously got a story behind him. Right, I'm going to take a picture of that. We'll have to find out what's happened to him. Can't leave that one alone.
So back home here in Northampton, I've done a little bit of research about this man, the Baron, in that cemetery, and he does have an incredible story. Of course he does, he's a Baron. But the thing that sticks out most of all in his story can be found in his obituary. It says that news has previously been received that Lord Lucas, as he was known, was missing. He'd been serving with the Royal Flying Corps in France, and he made a flight on November the 4th over the German lines, from which he did not return. He's now officially reported to have died. Captain Lord Lucas was born in 1876, the son of the Honourable Aberon Herbert, and he became a Baron upon his uncle's death in 1905. He'd been educated at Bedford School, and he'd rowed in the Oxford boat in the boat race, the famous London boat race, in 1888 and 1899. And during the South African, the Boer War, he was acting as a correspondent for the Times. He was wounded and his leg had to be amputated below the knee. So there's this man who's become a pilot in the First World War about 15 years after he's lost part of his leg. It says after a year as private secretary to the Secretary for War, he was appointed Under Secretary at the War Office in 1908. And in 1911, he became the Parliamentary Secretary to the Board of Agriculture. He was keenly interested in agriculture and a great nature lover. And in 1914, he entered the Cabinet as President of the Board of Agriculture, and he held this office until the coalition was formed in May of last year, when he was one of the ministers who retired. Then he gave up his political work and he joined the Royal Flying Corps, but he was many years over the standard age. He was a skillful pilot. He soon gained his certificate. He went out to Egypt, where he saw a good deal of service. When he came back to England, he was engaged for some months in instructing recruits for the Royal Flying Corps. But a few months ago, while he was coaching a pilot, his machine dived and the pilot was killed, but Lord Lucas escaped. He was offered command of a squadron out on the Western Front, but refused promotion until he gained experience in the fighting on the Western Front. He'd only recently gone out to France, and Lord Lucas had converted Rest Park, his seat in Bedfordshire, into a hospital for the wounded and offered it as a home for disabled soldiers after the war. He was unmarried, and the Lucas and Dingwall baronies passed by special remainder to his only sister. Now, I'm familiar with Rest Park. It's a building that's still there and is now owned by English Heritage and therefore is open to the public. And it was used as a hospital from August of 1914. At first, it was a convalescent home, and then it was transformed into a base hospital. And the Baron's sister compiled scrapbooks after the war. And if you go onto the English Heritage website and type in Rest Park, you can see more details of what it was like to be at Rest Park during the war. Soldiers arrived by train at the local Amptill station, where they were met by a fleet of ambulances and cars and transported to Rest Park. And then the soldiers were stripped and bathed and taken onto the wards. Nan Herbert, the Baron's sister, she was there. She wrote, "Train after train came in, and the convalescents were pushed on more rapidly than ever to the neighbouring convalescent homes in order to make room for more and more patients." More than 1,600 patients passed through Rest Park Hospital. Most of them were there just for a few weeks before moving on to convalescent homes. And while they were there, they were kept busy to keep up their morale. Some of the soldiers took part in amateur dramatics. They played cricket, they went fishing, and they played billiards. There was a medical officer that was there. There were three London-based surgeons and a team of about 24 nurses. But in September of 1916, Rest Park, the hospital there, its service came to an abrupt end because the mansion was badly damaged by fire. There were 156 patients there at the time. They were safely evacuated, but the damage was so serious that the hospital didn't reopen. Nan Herbert, she said about the fire, "In A ward, the patients, with great speed but with no sense of flurry, were rolled out in their beds onto the terrace and from there into the garden. Except for the pale, anxious faces, one would hardly have known that anything out of the ordinary was happening." And as I said, that was September 1916, and just 6 weeks later, further tragedy was to fall upon that great house there at Rest Park, because that's when the Baron was killed flying his machine over German lines. Now, the next cemetery that we went to really was one of those genuine battlefield cemeteries. And I thought I'd recorded the experience that we saw there, but I didn't have my microphone turned on, so I really was talking to myself. So I'll tell you a bit about it now. And it's called Rookery British Cemetery, near a village on the outskirts of Arras called Heninol. And this village was part of the German defensive system, and it was captured in a snowstorm on the 12th of April 1917, during that Battle of Arras, 3 days into it, by the 56th London Division, the 21st Division, the 50th Northumbrian Division. And after the fighting was over, the burial officer from two of those divisions collected up some of the dead and buried them in this location, which is named after a group of trenches. And there are just 55 First World War burials there, one of which is identified, and there were two further burials included in that 55 that were made in August 1918 during the 100-day offensive. And what took us to this particular cemetery was a man called George Stratford. Just a week or so before we went out to the battlefield, one of his relatives from the town of Desborough in Northamptonshire, where he was from, asked me to look into him. And we discovered that he was serving with the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment, one of those battalions that's very close to my heart. And he was killed in action on the 3rd of June 1917. And I thought to myself, well, that's after, a few weeks after the Battle of Arras had formally finished, according to the records. How did he manage to get killed on that day? Well, George had married a young lady called Louisa in April of 1912, and he was working, as so many of them were, in the boot and shoe industry. And their father was also a soldier that had fought in the Russian War in 1854. And George himself arrived in France in November 1916 and joined the 1st Battalion initially. And he soon found himself suffering from trench feet and dysentery during that awful winter of 1916-17. But he recovered and was transferred to the 6th Battalion. And on that day in early June 1917, the battalion was ordered to attack a German trench in what was described as a minor operation. That German trench was known as Horseshoe Trench. A plan was drawn up and the operation was carried out. Battalion diary says, 0 hour was at 11 p.m. The operation carried out as per the operation order with three platoons, one platoon attacking from the end of Lark Lane, supported by a wiring and consolidation party, another platoon attacking from the north. The success of the operation was largely due to Stokes mortars and the volume of rifle grenades that were fired. The trench was taken, 11 of the enemy were killed, and another 40 rifles were captured. Consolidation was carried out under extreme difficulty. The horseshoe was being continually shelled, and the shelling continued during the following day. Eight men were killed in that minor operation, including George, and George and six of his comrades are buried in this small battlefield cemetery. An article appeared in the local press, simply said, "We regret to hear of the death in France of Private George Stratford." The news was conveyed to his parents through a Rothwell chum writing to his friends. Mr. and Mrs. Stratford have six sons serving their king and country and were congratulated some 15 months ago by a letter from the king to the chairman of the local council. Previous to the war, George Stratford was employed by Messrs. Cheney and Sons, and he leaves a wife and two children and was 33 years of age. Those two children were both daughters. Ida had been born in 1914, so she was just 3 and a half when her father died. Doris was born in May of 1916, so she was just over a year. I wonder whether either of those girls remembered or knew what had happened to their father. I wonder whether they ever got to see his grave in the Rookery Cemetery. And those thoughts went through my head when, at the request of the family, I placed a small wooden poppy cross there and touched the top of the headstone. That was my tribute to George Stratford on behalf of his family. So as usual with me rambling on, I'm beginning to run out of time and I'm not even halfway through the stories that I planned to tell you. So I think what we're going to do is I'll do one more and then the others I'll turn into a second episode of the Arras Cemeteries, and we'll probably do that in a couple of weeks' time. So the final one this week is going to feature on a cemetery that I've been to a couple of times before. It's close to a village called Wancourt, a village that was also captured on the 12th of April 1917 after heavy fighting. And this cemetery was opened just 10 days later and was used right the way through until October 1918. But it was in German hands during that spring offensive period between March and August of 1918 after the Germans recaptured Wancourt. And then at the end of the war, when the armistice came along, there was just 410 graves here, but it's one of those that's been turned into a concentration cemetery with burials brought in from several different cemeteries in the area. And there's now nearly 1,936 burials and commemorations of the First World War here, and 829 of the burials are unidentified, with 76 casualties have special memorials because their graves are known or believed to be buried amongst them. And it was that man again, Sir Edwin Lutyens, as I said earlier, probably the most famous and well-known architect from the Great War. It was he that designed this cemetery. And the reason why it's familiar to me is because 10 years ago, I came here with a man called Paul Critchley. And in that year, 2016, Paul, who by trade is a reverend, was serving in the northwest of England when he decided at the age of 40 to take up the challenge of the Army Benevolent Fund's frontline walk. And he decided to dedicate the walk to a second Lieutenant Geoffrey Potts, who was killed in action and is buried here at Wancourt. And he was serving with the 17th Battalion of the Manchester Regiment. Now, Geoffrey was no relation to Paul, but Paul had become fascinated with his story because when he was serving at this church in Fylde, Lancashire, he found a memorial to him. And Paul said that he wanted to know more about Geoffrey and discovered what happened to him. And I remember researching the story for Paul. And the day before the walk began, we were staying at a hotel in Arras. So a couple of us and Paul got a taxi up to Wancourt. And it was a moment I'll never forget because Paul knelt at the grave of Geoffrey Potts, a man that he'd never met, a man he wasn't related to, but a man he'd become so fond of. And he said a quiet prayer at the graveside. There was lots of emotion and Paul was unable to speak for a few minutes afterwards. Even when I think back to it now, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about that moment. Finding that grave of Geoffrey Potts meant so much to Paul. And what was Geoffrey's story? Well, it was that date again, the 23rd of April 1917. The Battle of Arras had been going on for a couple of weeks and the 17th Manchesters were trying to break through again. At 4:45 a.m, the battalion moved forward, ready for the assault. And the men spent the next few hours digging themselves in. And at 9:00 a.m, the Germans launched a counterattack, which was repulsed with great gallantry and the position maintained. At 2:00 in the afternoon, the enemy attacked again. And the battalion suffered many casualties. And at midnight, the battalion was relieved, but they paid a heavy price. 650 men went into the assault that day, and 360 of them were killed, wounded, or reported missing. There was an eyewitness reported what happened. He says the regimental sergeant major, RSM Coates, performed excellent work during the assault, repeatedly bringing in wounded men under shellfire, organising the defence of the frontline trench and finding cover. And he was in a shell hole. He was looking after the mortally wounded Lieutenant Potts. It was eventually discovered that 87 men died on that day from the Manchesters, including Geoffrey. And having not been to the cemetery for a few years, I decided that as we were coming here to see another Northampton man who died on that same day, I would want to pay my respects again to Geoffrey Potts. So imagine my amazement when Susan, who was with us on this trip from Australia, opened the visitor's book and she found the last entry in the visitor's book said this. The entry was dated the 2nd of December 2025 from James Guest, who's living in France. He said, Geoffrey Potts, RIP, we now live in France. My late father was your cousin. There are 1,936 men buried in that cemetery. What are the chances of the last entry in a visitor's book being from someone that was related to the man that I had come to see? How can that happen? How do these coincidences keep happening to me and other people on the Western Front and beyond? It really does feel as though Potts and the others are reaching out to us from beyond. Perhaps they do know that we're visiting. If James Guest or anyone that knows him is listening to this podcast, please ask him to get in touch I'm sure Paul Critchley would like to speak to him. And I've got a file all about Geoffrey that I'd like to share with him. So that was Geoffrey, and the man that I'd come to see in the cemetery was an officer, Second Lieutenant Stuart Lenton Blaxley. We didn't find his grave because his headstone was one of those special memorials, which means he's believed or known to be buried here. But the actual location of his grave was lost in the later fighting. On his headstone, the family had chosen this inscription: a dearly loved only son, a great sacrifice for a great cause. 31, died on the 23rd of April. We can't cross that date before the newspaper tells us. Parents lived on East Park Parade in Northampton. In those days, it was a nice place to live. It's not now. And it says, with the deepest sorrow and sympathy, we add the name of Second Lieutenant Stuart Lenton Blackley to the pitiful role of only sons who've fallen. The irreparable loss of Blaxley and his family will have the sincerest sympathy of all who knew this young officer. He died a true soldier's death, and his captain writes, "Your son was killed in action on the 23rd whilst leading so splendidly and gallantly his men in an attack against the enemy. It grieves me more than I can say to lose one so brave and at the same time so capable. His commanding officer and your son delivered the attack the highest praise, and I trust it may come in some way to help your sorrow. The regiment can ill afford to lose an officer like this." Blaxley was 31 years of age and was educated at Northampton Town County School, which we mentioned earlier, what was the grammar school, now the boys' school. On leaving there, he was articled to Messrs Morgan and George, solicitors in Northampton, and on qualifying as a solicitor, entered the office of Mr Truman in Bicester, so he'd moved to Bicester. He joined the Inns of Court, Officer Training Corps, in November 1915, and received his commission in Royal Welsh Fusiliers a year later. Went to the front on January the 9th of 1917. So he was only out here a couple of months. While in Bicester, he was the secretary of the YMCA, and his fine manly character and intellectual gifts, he was exceptionally well informed and deeply read, and a great influence upon those with whom he came into contact. The deceased was also well known locally and a popular member of the Northampton Chess Club, and a keen and capable cricketer. His innings as life has been all too short. He leaves behind the bright and happy memories of a life lived and sacrificed for others. So many of those men from the grammar school, town and county boys school, became officers. And I think there's about 90 from that school that lost their lives. Just listening to that back again, and as always, when you think of these lads that went off to war, I think about my own life and the fact that I'm now probably, well, twice the age of Stuart Blaxley, and in some cases three times the age of the men that we've talked about this week, and how fortunate I've been to live the life that I've had so far in relative peace. And you wonder what these men would have achieved had the war not happened, or had they survived the war. What mark would they have left on the world? Another one of those questions that has no answer, we'll never know. And I suppose that's the tragedy of the Great War, and it's what takes us back, those thoughts is what takes us back time after time to the battlefields. And talking of the battlefields, well, first of all, thank you very much for listening to the podcast again this week. Please do continue to rate and review wherever you download it from. That really is very helpful. I'll return to the battlefields again this week, when we'll be visiting various locations on the Somme, and our journey will take us beyond the Somme to Luz. It will take us up to the coast near Abbeville, where there were base hospitals, and it will take us to the scene of the 1918 German spring offensive in March 1918, and it will take us to High Wood once again, the scene of horror in 1916. We'll be visiting all of these locations with the nine people that I'll be guiding on Terry's tours. My microphone will be coming with me, And when I come back, the stories that we find, the stories that we tell, the stories that we share will be shared with you in Tales from the Battlefields. And as usual, we pay tribute to the men whose graves we found in those cemeteries around Arras by the sounding of the last post.